Hello, everyone. So, I thought I'd read from that book I mentioned of Lone Paul Liam's. Most of you have heard me read it on many retreats, but just the background for those who you don't, for those of you who don't know who Lone Paul Liam is. Lone Paul Liam is about 80 years old, and he's been a monk for almost 60 years, Thai monk from the northeast of Thailand, comes from an agricultural family, so very little formal education. But he is the abbot of Wat Bapong, which is the monastery that Ajahn Chah started. And before Ajahn Chah fell ill, you know that Ajahn Chah was actually paralyzed or paralyzed for 10 years. Not able to move his body. Before he came down with, before he had those strokes or whatever, Lone Paul Liam, he appointed Lone Paul Liam to be the abbot of Wat Bapong, which is our home monastery in Thailand, and all the other monasteries throughout the world are sort of emanations of that. And so Lone Paul Liam was the abbot during all that time that Lone Paul Cha was incapacitated, and then now he's has his own disciples, and he's very, very much beloved by all of us. He's a very, very interesting monk, but also highly attained. And so in this book called No Worries, which I've asked many of you to read, I'll just read some bits in it. And see how that works for us this morning. So it's, the book is called No Worries, and someone just posted a PDF link to it, and this is in the section on his biography. Sound is okay, Vivian? All right. I came to Wat Bapong. So Wat Bapong, again, is Wat means monastery, Pa means forest, and Pom, I think, means swamp or something. So in Thailand, all the monasteries, our monasteries usually have the prefix Wat Pa Nanachat, Wat Pa Nong Pa Pong, and so on. So that's what it means. I came to Wat Pa Pong with a mind that was interested in the training. So I think Lone Paul Liam was a monk now less than a decade, maybe like 8 years he had been a monk, and very much kind of in the study realm of Thai Buddhism, and found that totally unsatisfactory and was fed up with study. And then he found Ajahn Chah, and he said, well, this monk I can trust, and this monk will give me good guidance. He had great faith in Lopa Cha. I came to Wat Bapong with a mind that was interested in the training, practice, and development of myself. I undertook some special practices all for myself. Again, this is probably 1960. This is 1969. So he would have been in his, 30 years old or something. For example, after the group meditation meetings in the evening, I took the opportunity to put forth some more effort in the practice, trying to develop diligence as a habit. I didn't socialize. I didn't relate to other monks. I didn't speak with anybody. In that rainy season, we were almost 50 altogether. If I remember correctly, 47. I didn't get into contact with anybody, living like somebody who really takes his chance. And the opportunities for practice were fantastic. I was trying to train myself in understanding all the feelings that arise when one is completely left to nature. If we are given a chance like this, we need to try hard and be resolute to use it. But it wasn't always the case that I was very diligent. Sometimes I also felt lazy. Laziness comes up with when egotistical feelings take hold of us. What I did to face this was to ask myself constantly, what have I come here to do? And so skip a little bit. And this is the writer of, that's Lone Paul Liam's voice. This is the writer of the book. The rains retreat is a time when the monks of a monastery usually intensify their efforts and practice. Bonpas's high aspirations and motivation led to a powerful experience at the beginning of the rainy season, of which he tells. I experienced something stranger than anything I had ever experienced before. From the beginning of the rains retreat on up to the second month, I felt great sadha, great faith in the practice. There was no decline, no thoughts of discouragement at all in my practice. The practice went well the whole time, although there were a few experiences of the mind getting involved with desires and defilements, but they weren't very strong. So obviously, Lompos has a lot of barami, as we say. He's very developed. He's been working, you know, very hard, just constantly practicing mindfulness, awareness. So then again, the writer of the book, around the middle of the rainy season of the year 1969, Lompu, in terms of honorifics, you have Lompo, you have Ajahn, you have Bhikkhu, you have Lompo, Lompu, and they're not titles, they're honorifics that the Thai people use in a sense of endearment and honor. So Lompu is like venerable grandfather, and Lompo is like venerable father, but it almost has like Lompo is like grandfather, and Lompu is great-great-grandfather. So you have these, and you have to understand the Thai use of honorifics. They have a lot, because it's a very endearing language. So they have ways of endearment and respect that they can use in different circumstances. They're not titles. So when people started to call me Lone Paul, they thought I had kind of like more pips on my shoulder or something, some kind of insignia or whatever. But no, it's just kind of a term of endearment for an old monk. So around the middle of the rainy season of the year 1969, Lone Pu Cha encouraged the monks to practice with special intensity. They weren't supposed to speak to each other, and the communal morning and evening meetings for chanting and meditation were canceled. Lompu Cha saw that it was the time to give the monks more opportunity to do this practice on their own. So Lompu Liam increased his efforts, and as he did so, results became evident. On the 9th of September, around 10 p.m., he experienced an immense transformation in his mind. He had a feeling of extraordinary brightness and happiness, of which he reports. It is impossible to describe this kind of happiness to someone else. It is impossible to make someone else know and understand it. It isn't the happiness of getting things according to one's wishes, and not the happiness because things are agreeable. It's the kind of happiness that goes beyond these two. Walking is happiness, sitting is happiness, standing is happiness, and lying down is happiness. There is the experience of delight and joy all the time. Furthermore, one is able to uphold the knowledge in one's mind that this happiness arises completely by itself and eventually will vanish by itself. Both sukha and dukkha in an experience like this are still entirely impermanent states. I was able to maintain the knowledge of this fact all the time. In every posture, standing, walking, sitting, and lying down, there was a continuous and equal experience of happiness. The state was the same whether I was doing sitting or walking meditation. If one were to try to describe the mind in this state, one could say there is brightness, but the word bright actually doesn't describe correctly what the experience is like. It's as if there is nothing that can make the mind get involved with anything. This experience lasted for a day and then changed again. Then the mind became utterly peaceful, not at all exhausted, tired, or sleepy, but filled with clarity, radiance, and coolness, imbued with various kinds of delight and rapture. This experience lasted completely without reference to time. It was truly akaliko, timeless. The same feeling continued on through all four postures. Eventually, I asked myself, what is this? And the answer was a mode of the mind. It is like this in itself. When there is happiness, we simply take it as happiness. It is simply a matter of happiness. When there's peace, we simply take it as a matter of peace. And we just look at our happiness on and on. We just look at our peace on and on unremittingly. So what I take from that is not just the bliss of the experience, but the capacity of awareness. Because I think, you know, when you get an experience which is extraordinary, you get very excited by it and lose awareness maybe and think, well, what have I gotten? What is that? And then try to repeat and come back to that in a future meditation and maybe feel frustrated. And for me, what's really important in this is that Lompo is obviously he's practicing awareness unremittingly. And that to me isn't concentration unremittingly. He's not like absorbed. He's very with life. But it's kind of unremitting awareness of anicca dukkha anatta. And to me, that's a kind of better definition of sama samadhi than right concentration. There's composure, there's focus, all that's going on, but it's not separate from the world, like some kind of absorption into an object where you're not with the world. At least that's how I like to interpret it. You'll have your own way of interpreting it. Eventually, on the evening of the 10th of September, a change to something new that Lompo hadn't experienced before took place. A feeling of weariness, frustration, and fatigue took over. Whenever he sat or walked, he felt sleepy. Even after he got up, after having rested, the tiredness remained. In each posture, he felt completely exhausted. He got to the point where he fell asleep while he was doing walking meditation and ran into some thorns. His whole face became scratched and sore. And this is Lompo Liam in quotes. "At least the sleepiness will disappear now," end quote, he thought, but the fatigue continued to remain as strong as before. Still he endured, telling himself that it is natural to face obstacles in the practice, which to some extent everybody needs to pass. With these reflections in mind, he understood that he needed to look at this tiredness that previously hadn't been present. After all, this fatigue just arose, so it was impermanent too. Using this insight, he attempted to maintain awareness of sleepiness. On the 11th, Lompo experienced another change, namely a great peace and happiness returned to his mind. In all four postures, there was clarity and gladness. Simply being by himself was very pleasant. Nothing could intrude and stir up his mind. External objects impinging on the mind just couldn't reach it. When working together with the monks and novices during chores, although he was together with others, he felt the same as if alone. He wasn't interested in what they were talking or chatting about. He couldn't be bothered to think about what was happening at all, and when the chores were finished, he simply went back to his hut. The next day passed with the ongoing happiness and peace continuing as if it was a normal and ordinary experience. With unceasing attention. And this is sort of, again, if your vision of Theravada Buddhism is strong concentration and absorption, and you read this, well, you know, he's hauling water. He's with the monks. You know, he's a normal monk in some way. He's not a catatonic, an amateur catatonic. He's with the situation. But unremitting mindfulness, and that might be an interesting way to think of sama samadhi rather than these ideas of absorption. I'm not saying they're wrong, but I do wonder if they're not a bit misleading. So he's you could say he's very focused, but it's not on an object. It's about presence. It's about awareness. It's about knowing the way things are. But at least that's how I interpret it. He couldn't be bothered to think much about what was happening at all. And when the chores were finished, he simply went back to his hut. The next day passed with the ongoing happiness and peace continuing, as if it was a normal and ordinary experience. With unceasing attention, Lompo continued to look at both his mind and the objects of his mind. When the evening of the 12th approached, he started to question himself. Why do we really practice? What's all this practice for? And the answer arose, we don't practice for anything. We practice for the sake of practice. Whatever it will lead to doesn't matter at all. Our duty is to practice, so we practice and try to maintain mindfulness and awareness with it. In each moment, we keep teaching ourselves. Whatever we are doing, we try to have mindfulness and awareness. Whether we are walking to or fro, we keep everything in a state of perfect balance. So doubt arises. What is this for? He doesn't go off into analysis and read a book, right? He's just there. Oh, why do we practice? We practice for the sake of practice. It doesn't get caught in the intellect trying to figure something out, because that would be another condition. Finally, all of you know I love this kind of the understatement of this paragraph. Finally, I felt I had done enough walking meditation for that day because I became quite tired and my feet already hurt very much. The bones of my feet felt like they were piercing through the skin. Here's the line. Here's the understatement. As I had been walking the whole day and night without rest. So, I mean, who could do that? An extraordinary human can do that. That he has this resilience and determination to have unremitting mindfulness doing walking meditation all that time. And so then, so as I had been walking the whole day and night without rest, and this is the kind of beautiful understatement, it is normal to experience painful feelings in the body if we overuse a single posture. But it is also normal that feelings change again. So I thought, it's really enough walking meditation for today. I went up to my hut, put on my robe with the right shoulder open and the outer robe folded over the left shoulder, sat down facing east, the same direction as Lumpu Cha's hut, thought of my teacher and started meditating. The meditation was very peaceful and the same reflection as before came up in Lumpu's mind. We don't practice for anything. We practice for the sake of practice. And this is Lumpu again. Keeping this teaching in my mind, I kept on meditating. Normally, I would sit meditation until about 10 or 11 p.m. and then stop to have a rest. But on this day, I continued sitting for about 8 hours without moving or making the slightest change in posture. And again, I mean, who can do that, right? Who can do that? So it sounds, well, that's not for me, you know. I gotta do the seal posture and I'm finished after half an hour or something. but if you don't take that incredible part of me that he has, right? Because he's obviously bringing a lot into this lifetime, and he's an amazing person. But if you just take what's he actually doing, unremitting mindfulness and awareness, that we can take from this, right? But he's also like putting a fair bit of effort into doing that a lot, right? So certainly when, you know, young monks read about this, such as me, and then they try to sit without moving, then they usually have arthroscopies afterwards because they do their knees. And so this cannot be done with willfulness. You know, just willfully holding a posture and not moving is not mindfulness. Right, it's still bound by ego, so it's not as straightforward as just not moving. It has to be done with mindfulness, and if you can do that with mindfulness and not hurt yourself, then hats off to you, right? But it doesn't require that. It requires more the understanding of continued unremitting mindfulness and awareness. So keeping this teaching in mind, I kept on meditating, and so on. With this experience of peace, the mind changed. The feeling of peacefulness shot up and pervaded throughout the whole body as if something were taking hold over it. It felt cool, a coolness that suffused the whole body, so very cool, an experience of the whole body becoming completely light and at ease. The head felt so cool the whole day and night as if there was a fan blowing over it, cool, peaceful, quiet, and still. No experience of thoughts at all. And no clue at all where they had disappeared. Everything silent, completely. It felt totally quiet. The only experience left was that of utter peace and stillness. The body felt tranquil, cool, and light. This experience continued on throughout the whole year, ladies and gentlemen. Right? It wasn't like, you know, an afternoon, but this is even more. This experience continued on throughout the whole year, not just for a day or two. In fact, it has continued unchanging for many years, all from that one go. So then you have someone who has realized the unchanging, the unconditioned peace, the harbor. And in very ordinary language, too, this is what I think we all love about this. It's not technical, that kind of special jargon. It's just ordinary language, but an extraordinary man. So the experience continued on throughout the whole year, not just for a day or two. In fact, it has continued unchanging for many years, all from that one go. There is a state of coolness, as if in the brain, whether sitting or lying down, coolness in every position. All worries, concerns, or similar thoughts from the thinking mind are totally gone. Thinking in this or that direction ceased. All quiet, just like a forest where there isn't the slightest sound of any bird singing. Truly quiet. No wind blowing at all, just ongoing tranquility and peace. It feels as if there are no sankharas. And sankharas, we call it, these are the compounded or fabrications or made up things. It feels like there are no sankharas, no proliferations of the mind. All the suffering that arises with kilesas that had bothered me before, the kilesas concerning the other sex or all kinds of ambitions that I had before, I don't know where they all disappeared. Seeing somebody, and this is interesting, seeing somebody, I just had the feeling of seeing it as absolutely normal. To see a person as simply a person, just that much. No beautiful persons, no ugly persons. People simply would be specifically the way they were. This is the kind of peace and tranquility that arose. I don't know what it was, but I also didn't care what it was, always knowing it is like this by itself in just this way. It is like this through peacefulness and tranquility. There isn't anything to be concerned about as far as how various things exist. As concerns dukkha, I don't know what dukkha is like. As concerns laziness, I don't know what laziness is like. Questioning myself about laziness, there wasn't any. Questioning myself about dukkha, there wasn't any. The feeling inside my heart was exactly like this. I tried to recall and pin down that which is called dukkha. What is it? I really don't know. I only know how they discern the meaning in terms of conventional language, because dukkha is just something created by common conventions. When the mind has no dukkha, all conventions whatsoever don't exist in the mind. And the experience of this feeling has lasted on continuously all the time since then. There has been no change at all the way up to the present day. The same state still lasts on and has been stable, continuous, and without changes. Oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So now, just to give you the context, Lompo Liem is the abbot of our biggest monastery. There's probably 60 monks there. And every year on the 16th of January, I don't know what's going to happen this year, but there's a large gathering, and it's been, which commemorates the passing of Lompo Cha. And it's a 4-day event, and over those 4 days, 20 to 30,000 people invade the monastery. And on the ultimate day, there's a circumambulation around Lompo Cha Stupa. And when I was there, there were, I think, 1,200 monks. I don't know how many nuns there were. There may be several hundred nuns. Maybe 5,000-10,000 lay people. Place is just packed out. And then two days later, I went to see Lompo Liem, and he said, "How was that? How was the gathering?" He said, "Oh, that was just about the right size." So it's like, it's not, he's not at all disengaged with life. He's fully with life, and he's totally unbothered by it. And brilliant at what he does. He still climbs scaffolding and does cement work, and you know, so and many people who don't know him, when they see him sweeping leaves, they think he's a janitor or something. So he'll be sweeping leaves, and people say, "Where does the abbot stay?" And he points to his kuti. Hey, see, he stays over there, and he keeps sweeping the leaves. So he's just a very, very interesting man. He's very quiet, very, very quiet. So now, what, you know, what does that kind of story do for your consciousness? Well, certainly it kind of portrays the awe of this being called the Buddha, I think, because then you have a real life example of this possibility. And hopefully when one recites Namo Tassa, one gets that sense of, wow, this is an amazing being. This was an amazing being that we have the good fortune to still hear his echoes, as it were. And that to me is an optimism, isn't it? It's like, it's a really optimistic teaching as a possibility. And then how do you do that? Well, we're not that gifted as Lompo Liam. So Lompo Cha would say to a lot of Western monks, he said, you know, you want to get enlightened overnight, but you're not the Buddha. You know, that's not who you are. You have to build barami. You have to be patient. You have to build up reserves of patience and kindness and conviviality and focus and composure. And you have to work. So it was always couched in that reasonable way. And then you see someone like Lompo Liam, you realize, oh, he's really advanced. You know, this man has so many gifts that I don't have. But what is he saying to me? He's saying, unremitting mindfulness and awareness. I can do that, or a bit. I can approach that. He's not asking me to get all those states of mind that he's experiencing. I can work with that. And he can inspire me in that way. So the possibilities that these beings realize are very profound, very, very profound. And yet he questions himself. He says, why do we practice? We practice for the sake of practice. I can, you know, that's not esoteric at all. That's very, very relevant in my own life. So anyway, I, those of you who have done retreats with me, this must be the 20th time you've heard that, but it's always inspiring, isn't it? I find it is. It's always inspiring, uplifting. Stories are good that way. So let's do some sitting, huh? Perhaps the reading is really sufficient for you know, inspiring us. So whatever you took away from that, use that. Use that in how you practice right now. So let's sit quietly for this period. All right, everyone, we'll see you on the next chapter. Goodbye for now.